session number 23195, rule 6.
Mr. Bolton, rule 6. We've talked about when we were establishing the regimental positions at Plumetot in Normandy, and we talked about the telephone switchboard dugout, which you laid. Now, what about what you did in it? I mean, what was a typical shift or rota or roster that you had established? How would you work in there?
I think that's two of us doing it. I should have mentioned earlier that not all of the signal section actually came on this first landing. Others followed later. We were on a kind of skeleton staffing arrangement in order to get to cope with the vast numbers of troops being landed on the shipping available. And we weren't, in fact, joined by the rear party, as it was called, until perhaps 2 weeks later. So on the switchboard, I did 4 hours on and 4 hours off through the 24 hours.
And what would you do in a four-hour shift?
Just sit there and wait for a request for a line. A light would come up. Then somebody would say in the order room would ask to be put through to the battery. The two battery lines were always busy, or be connected to perhaps the medical officer had a line, or the quartermaster, or other lines like that.
If the line was busy, what would you do? I mean, if they'd already got a line connected to the battery.
Engage was the formula, I think. Try again, or one would be asked to keep trying, and you had to make a quick note and keep bashing away.
Anything else you had to do on switchboard?
I think that was the only duty. Of course, there were fatigues round about, and occasionally I fell for those when I was supposedly off duty.
What sort of fatigues would you have?
I think we gave the cookhouse a helping hand, peeling spuds and that sort of thing. Although, it was a bit later on, really. Things like, I'm slightly digressing at the moment, after about a fortnight on ration biscuits, bakeries were opened somewhere in the rear and bread was delivered. Anyway, well, tell me
about the food then. Let's go on to food. Were you on? You got the 24-hour pack, and then would you be on compo rations?
You went on compo rations.
Can you tell me what compo was and how the system worked? Because people aren't familiar with it now.
Okay. Well, the cookhouse took over all the rations, so we didn't do it ourselves. They handled this. The compo rations consisted of tins, ordinary round tins, which one opened with one's jackknife, which had a new gadget for taking stones out of horses' shoes or whatever. And there was a selection of the main part of the meal, which was a meat stew. There was a beef stew, there was a mutton stew, there was a pork stew. I think that was the range of the items.
What were they like? I mean, were they appetizing or
They were actually appetizing. Now, that was my opinion. I should emphasize that's an opinion because they've always been widely criticized by everybody, and no one was ever prepared to admit that the food was any good at all, but except me. Well, I kept quiet about it, but I always enjoyed it. I was always hungry. And in fact, I think, and I still think, that these tins of stew were appetizing. The pork one was a favorite, and everybody felt that. It was rather richer than the rest. It had more taste to it, but they were all quite good. And we also got a sweet, which also came up in a tin, I think, some plum duff or jam pudding or rice pudding. So we had two courses with ration biscuits until the bread arrived, and margarine.
What were the ration biscuits like?
They weren't bad. I think they were a bit better than the ones that my dad used to talk about in the First World War. But they were not appetizing. They had very little flavor, and they were quite hard. So, well bespattered, well smothered with margarine and jam, they were edible. But it was a relief when bread started to come up, which was when bakehouses were established somewhere on shore and bread was sent out with the rations.
Anything else in the compo food line, the boxes?
I think there must have been. That was dinner, sort of main meal of the day. And then in the afternoon we had supper or whatever. And then that was basically just biscuits or later bread and jam and whatnot. And cheese. A lot of cheese always provided. Um, Since we're getting sugar by then, there must have been some of the tea. And although, of course, there's army tea always had sugar in it. I'm trying to remember now. I think it came up always, you know, in an ordinary dining hall. You've got sweetened tea. So if you didn't take sugar or didn't like it, it was too bad, I suppose. So food was quite good, to my mind, and it was always adequate, certainly. There was plenty of it. These tins were, you know, a decent meal.
Now, while during this early period, you weren't doing any wireless work at all. It was switchboard work. There was no function for the wireless system. Were they sending out, reconnaissance, but forward observation officers with a wireless team, or was that not going on?
That was going on, but that was done by the artillery signals, because there were, in fact, two levels, as it were, of signals operations in the Royal Artillery Regiment.
What was the role of the Royal Artillery signals? If you could just, what was it, how well qualified were they in comparison to yourselves?
They were, I think, similarly trained, and they seemed to be quite competent. They handled their radios very well, which was our contact with them. So they handled the all the signals at the battery level, from battery to RHQ. We ourselves handled the net from RHQ, the command net, to the two batteries. And we had a rear net, that was a forward net. We had a rear net from RHQ and a separate set, which went to the rear to Army Group Artillery Headquarters, which instructions came. Now, the Royal Artillery signalers handled their side of it at the batteries, so we never got beyond or below RHQ level, apart from calling them and having them on our net.
Were the gun positioned near the RHQ?
Generally speaking, they were always, nearly always, quite near. Just depends on the lie of the land.
By near, meaning?
A few hundred yards away or a quarter of a mile. Not all that close, in a sense.
And would you go and visit them out of interest? I mean, I appreciate you didn't have any reason to visit them, other than possibly just wanted to go and see their guns.
No, I think hardly ever. I can't recall that. Just why now, I don't know, because it seems to me now, that was a great pity. I wish I had been had a little tour around. I think it was all strictly forbidden, really, because we had an RSM right there on the spot. And, we were sort of under heavy discipline. It gradually relaxed as time went on, of course. And,
What's the course of events then? You landed, took up field. Were the battery in action? Oh, sorry, the regiment in action. They were firing.
They were in action pretty quick, I think, just perhaps a matter of hours after they'd arrived. And they may well have dug gun pits right away, I don't know. That was a big job they always had to do, dig a gun pit, which is about half the size of this room to take a big 5.5 gun. So they sometimes got the help of a bulldozer from the engineers, if they could scrounge one and get one to work for them. So I think they were firing right away.
This is separate from you?
Yeah, quite separate from us, yes. And we really had very little to do with that side of it.
Now, what happened next, then, for you at RHQ?
From then on, I think we fell into a routine, which each day was much the same as the previous one.
So what would a typical day be like, if you could remember?
Right, first of all, we'll start off with sleeping. Most important thing to get one sleep. Although we slept in holes, we lay in the earth with a ground sheet and one's blanket. I think we had at least one blanket, maybe two. I was going to follow later with the rear party. So one huddled oneself into the hole, and around about 11 o'clock at night, because we were always stood to every night. And here again, something we never had to do before, never did that in England.
What was stand to then?
Stand to meant putting on your equipment, taking your rifle, tin hat, sort of reporting to the sergeant, who would tell you where to go, and then taking up positions on the perimeter of our little field. And there we peered through the increasing gloom. Of course, this was in June. It was light very late at night, which was a pity, really, because we had to wait until stand to before we could bed down properly. So we stood to for about 10 or 15 minutes, looking out for any wandering Germans. Most unlikely at that time, although that was a feature we came across later. Then we were dismissed. and climbed into one's hole, and that wasn't my 4-hour duty at that point. I'd sleep for 4 hours. Tried to sleep. Very difficult. It's like earth used to trickle down from the top into one's ears, and of course you got used to that after a while. The weather at first was quite good. Then we got a lot of rain, so we often had rain trickling down. We tried to improvise covers over the top, but we didn't have nothing adequate to do that. So we had just a gas cape, which is waterproof, and we made the best use of that we could. So I usually woke up in the morning wet with my boots, a bit of water in them. But in the meantime, one's sleep was always disturbed, because although, as is well known, we had total air superiority over the beaches, over the battle area, that didn't prevent the Luftwaffe from sending over the occasional plane. So every night for some time, I remember, we were woken up by a noise of the aero engines. We knew it was Jerry. And much worse than that, all the AK guns in this rather confined area of the beachhead all opened fire. I suppose there must have been hundreds of them. Lots and lots of Bofors, which fire, as you know, one after another, five shots, bang, 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 bang. So the night air was full of noise. Most of the stuff going up, with occasional explosions of bombs coming down and whistling. It was very hard to sleep. So really, until we got used to it, the first few nights we hardly seemed to sleep at all. I never slept very much. Constantly disturbed. One night, a nearby ammunition dump, of which there were many all over the place, that was hit by a bomb, and about 24 hours the contents continued to explode. And loud bangs and whirring noises as things flew through the air. That was quite exciting.
So, now would you be woken after 4 hours to do your stint in the switchboard?
That's right, yes. I think the chap was doing it just scrambled out of the switchboard hole and came over and shook me up and made sure I was awake.
Was there much switchboard duty in it, or was it just sitting?
Mostly, at night especially, it was sitting there. You sat there, and you might go almost 4 hours, barely a call, you might get one or two. Perhaps somebody in the orderly room might give you a call to make sure you're awake. Now, that was important.
I was going to ask about that.
Yeah, because the most terrible aspect of this evening was that at night, as you said, your eyelids droop, an overpowering desire for sleep came upon you. You had to fight against it. And that really was a big problem. Because if you did fall asleep and you would discover the sleep, you were on a charge right away.
How did you manage it? Because it's easy enough to say,
I didn't really. I kept falling asleep. Started dreaming, thinking I was still awake. Then my chin would hit my chest, and I'd wake up again. And go through the whole thing again, over and over again. Occasionally, I'd have to on one or two occasions, I did wake to my horror to find a light. Because the other thing was, we had a night alarm, so-called night alarm. It was simply a bell which plugged into the switchboard. So every time you were required, every time there was a call coming through, the light came on and the bell or the buzzer buzzed, whatever, which was enough to wake you up. So one would wake up at the start of the noise, gosh, how long has that been on? You shove your plug quickly into the appropriate hole, take the call and deal with it. And if you put someone through, as you sometimes did, you say, yeah, okay, I've got to disconnect that in a minute. And one would then fall asleep. And then you'll get wakened up, hopefully. But the point was that after you've been woken up by the buzzer and you put the call through and settled back, you forgot, because you were still half asleep, you forgot to put the buzzer, the plug back in. So the next time someone came on, it was a light, and there was you, sound asleep. So occasionally someone came to see what the hell's going on and woke me up. But one of our operators, got caught red-handed by an officer. Sometime in the middle of the night, the officer came round and found him fast asleep. So we got charged and was awarded 7 days field punishment, I recall, which meant he was taken off duty, which was annoying to the rest of us because it was a pair of hands short, and spent the days doing cookhouse fatigues, beating up empty tins and digging holes to bury them in, that kind of thing. So that was a penalty.
That was quite tough. So if you'd done your 4 hours in the night, you could go back to sleep.
That's right. Yes, you'd go back and climb into your hole, pull the blanket over, and try and sleep. And of course, the more we
was
did
it four on, four off, right through the day?
Yes.
At that time it was,
for a short time. For about two or three weeks later, our reinforcements arrived, the rear party, and then it got more like 4 hours on and 8 hours off, which is the standard thing.
So during this typical day, so you've got it up a couple of times in the night almost to do your duty, or once certainly. What would happen next? Getting up in the morning?
Breakfast. I'll go down to the cookhouse and get one's mug of tea and fried bacon, sausage, baked beans, quite good. Porridge. I think we always got porridge. Which one? Welcomed. Quite filling. retire from, just stand around the cookhouse or wherever and eat that, and then go and wash our mess tins. We usually, washing like that, we use the RHQ tank vehicle, because every unit had its own sort of water tank, which is a specially designed vehicle with a tank on the back. I know I'm talking to the initiated know this, but so we used to go to the tap on the back and just turn it on, water would gush out, and we'd wash our mess tins.
Was it an adequate supply? I mean, were you able to wash and shave, enough to wash and shave?
Yes. The driver of the tank was always told where he should go to get his supplies. Just how that was done, I don't know. But yes, it was always adequate. Apart from the short time when the tank was away being filled up, it was always there. One could just go to the tap and get water, washing, shaving, and so on.
Well, shaving, would you always shave? I mean, was that still expected?
It was still expected, yes, very much so. You're expected to be a soldier-like at all times. I think on about that very first or second day there, after our arrival in this field, the RSM told our sergeant to get us all together, although it's not on duty, and gave us a brisk pep talk about the importance of keeping your boots polished and your equipment clean and wearing it at all times and being ready for instant action. And prefaced his remarks by saying, you think that now you're in action, you can do what you like, but you're still soldiers, you'll still do what I tell you to do, and you will be properly dressed at all times, and so on. I would add in parenthesis that didn't really last very long, and later on we were left much to ourselves as long as we did our work. Against shirt sleeve order, and I got more comfortable.
Now, what happened next in the day then? So you'd breakfast, washed, shaved. What then?
Went on duty when necessary. Otherwise, one found ways of passing the time, writing letters home. And post arrived quite early on.
Well, tell me about sort of the letter contact both ways. I mean, how often would you get posts from home, and what sort of letters would be in it? I mean, what would your family write to?
Well, the post started arriving very soon. I can't say now just exactly when, but within a matter of days, anyway, I think, of our arrival there, post began to come in. And after that, it was always very regular, and there was a daily delivery. And somebody from our orderly room would come over and shout post, and we'd all rush up, gather round, and hopefully get a letter.
Who would you get letters from?
From my mum and dad, basically, parents at home. I started writing right away and sent off my little letters, giving some sort of description of what was going on.
Was it a truthful description, or would you sort of...
It was limited, because the letters were censored. In other words, having written your letter, you put it into the envelope without sticking it down, and there was a collection point, I suppose, for this, and one of the officers would censor it. I think he perhaps initialed it, I'm not quite sure.
What would you write about then? I mean, how?
Wrote about one's daily life and one's food and the weather and to a little bit saying what one was doing. That was all allowed. As long as you didn't describe it, as long as you made no mention of places or particular actions. So I was a little bit careful. So our letters were rather banal and basically cheerful. One always took care to say, I'm fine, it's all right, it's not too bad, not as bad as I thought.
And what would your parents write? I mean, back to you. I mean, what would they write about, typically?
Neither of them were very good at letter writing, which parents were in those days. So the letters were fairly brief. About 2 pages of my mother who did all the writing. About 2 pages, lines. Have your letter, she would say, once my letter started arriving, glad you're all right, and we're all right here, and the weather's nice, and There really wasn't much more than that. They were hard put to.
And how often would you exchange? I mean, was this? Would you all write? Would you write daily, you and your mum, to each other, or was it?
No,
once a week,
I think
or twice a week,
once a week might have been sometimes twice a week. But, so one welcomed the post enormously, and I was glad to write the odd letter. But
Did you have any other pen pals? You know, the sort of people. Because there were people who would write to soldiers and things to sort of. As pen pals.
Hmm.
Did you get any of those?
No, none of that. Occasional letter from another relative, uncle or aunt, or from
about
a friend.
Parcels? Did you get any parcels?
Yes, I would get a parcel from time to time from home, always containing cake. And, I think that was about all it did contain, actually, which was very welcome. And of course, every time a parcel arrived for one of us, my own little group, the operators basically, we were together as a little group. We always shared the contents, so we had quite a variety of cake, home-baked cake, and that was nice. I'm always pleased by that. The post always arrived very regularly, and it was a great morale booster. It worked very well indeed.
So that's you know, we were going through sort of typical day, and sort of bit of duty, about 4 hours on,
right.
And then possibly the letters would arrive. What else might happen in the morning?
We get detail for our fatigue. The RA cookhouse would ask for volunteers, not for volunteers, but for men to do some work. So our sergeant would sort someone up. Say, come
what
on
were the cookhouse fatigues like? Can you describe what would go on in the cookhouse for you as a on fatigue?
I think there were two activities really, either washing dishes, you know, large iron kettles and pots and things like that, which had to be scrubbed with. We usually get some hot water. The cookhouse had its own. Primitive ovens, sort of metal framework in which pots were put with a flue below, and at the end of it a very large blowpipe type burner was put, and I suppose filled with petrol or something, blazed away and heated the whole thing. So we used to put a pot on top of there full of water and get some hot water and some kind of, wouldn't be detergent in those days, some soap flakes or whatever were available. Scrub
so you
the pots
could get the grease off, because the pots must have been...
That's right. It was difficult. It was a rotten job. We disliked it very much. It was so greasy and dirty and black. But we could get them more or less clean enough to pass muster. Because the orderly officer came round every day and inspected the cookhouse.
So that was one of the cookhouse. What was the other cookhouse fatigue? You said there were two. Peeling potatoes.
Mainly peeling potatoes, yes, that's right. Of course, potatoes, it was a very large cauldron, about 3 feet wide, or a bath, a tin bath, and scores, dozens, hundreds of spuds in it. And two or three of us would sit round with our, with our jackknives or a knife borrowed from the cookhouse and peel away, rather carelessly on the whole. it was boring in one way, but we would chat, and it wasn't too bad.
So that's another thing that might happen in the morning.
Cleaning up the latrines. Now, the latrines were simply holes dug in the ground, but we did have our own portable sort of laboratory seat and whatnot, sort of big box, which went over the hole in the ground.
What they call a thunder box in the old...
That's
the
right.
It's
not a term we use very much. I think they probably use a rather coarser one, but thunder box is the widely used, I think. And that had some canvas frame around it, wooden frame, and canvas sheeting. And this were things which were carried on one of the RHQ lorries. One of the lorries carried the sanitary gear on it, and others carried the cookhouse gear and whatnot.
And what was latrine fatigue?
I suppose just scrubbing the seats and whatnot, because that was all it would have been. Because once the sort of drain-off area, the holes below, began to fill up, then one simply... shoveled earth on top of it. That was a little fatigue there to finish it off.
Well, did they still used to put quicklime on it?
I think they did, yes. Now you mention that. There was white powder that got sprinkled down while it was in use, and then it was finished with. Then you shut it off and just dug a fresh one next door, as it were. So that was the kind of fatigue that we helped with, I think. We avoided it when we could.
What else, going through the day, what else might you be on?
I suppose a bit of tidying up generally around the site. And the guard duty was a regular thing.
Well, that's interesting. Guard duty, what did that entail?
One paraded. This mainly done, if we were really busy and everybody, if the operators were all doing switchboard or wireless work, then you were on four hours on, four off. So you didn't do guard duty. But as soon as there was any change in that, you were temporarily unemployed, then you got roped in. Otherwise, the drivers were continually doing guards. because they had, apart from maintaining their vehicles, which when they were stationary for 2 or 3 weeks and then was simple. So they often did guard duty. So you mustered at 6 o'clock in the evening, and the NCO would appear, usually the sergeant. Stood in a little group of six, I think it was, two of you, one at a time. And your rifle or Sten gun or whatever was inspected. No ammunition, mind you. Just mentioned in passing, although we were in action, none of us had any ammunition, as far as I can recall. Not quite sure about that. Perhaps we did. Perhaps we've got an original issue of cartridges into our belts and our equipment, and then, of course, we never fired them, so they stayed. Yeah, perhaps I think perhaps we did have that ammunition.
So what was it? What? So you gathered with your weapons?
You were inspected. You expected to have your boots clean and everything else properly done, and your... I think the one thing we might have been let off was brass polishing. Not sure about that. In theory, that might have given us away to the enemy, highly polished brasses. So I think perhaps we were let off. And then I think the guard, I think they were required to sleep together, so we had a little guard room, a guard tent or whatever. I'm not quite sure. Well, we may have just gone back to our... I think we probably went back to our hole. That was the only practical way of doing it. Then the chap coming, when he'd done his 2 hours, would come over and shake you up and get you out of bed. So during the 2 hours you were on duty, you stood at the entrance to the field. There was a sort of gap between the hedges and a bit of a track out there. Sort of farm track, and vehicles used that and come along, and one stood there to challenge anyone who appeared.
You weren't sort of patrolling around the thing?
Not on that first sight. Sometimes one did that later on. It depended very much on the sort of aspect of where you were and what the possible dangers might be and so on. But here, the only thing we did, and it wasn't exactly patrolling, but the stand to. And after that, it was left to the guards. Did their little bit
anything
of...
Anything else you might be doing during the day?
I'd perhaps just mention one little incident when I was on guard duty, which shows all the things you got into. We got a telephone call. Now this was it was one morning. Got a telephone call. The adjutant had a phone call from the one of the batteries, said that they had a lance bombardier who'd been accidentally shot during the night, or in fact killed, shot through the head. So the assistant adjutant, lieutenant, came over to me. I was on. Get it straight. The assistant adjutant went off to the battery and then picked up the body and brought it back to RHQ. Some question of identifying it. I suppose it because it was an shooting by, shot by his own side, so it made it rather important. So the body of this unfortunate chap was brought back. And I happened to be on guard duty at the entrance when he came in with this little van, little 1500 weight. Stopped inside. They called me over and said, "Give us a hand." And I was required to lift out the help to lift out the body laid out. Now that was of interest in my story because that was the first corpse I saw. Despite all the action that had gone on all this time, I never saw a body up to that time. Not really surprising, perhaps, was one thing. If we were moving about outside, we were always in a truck, and I was always in the back of the truck, and the visibility was limited. And there might have been a dozen dead people lying outside. I might not even see them as they went by. The only other general comment I make on that was that there seemed to be a remarkably good system of removing casualties. So very rarely did I actually see a body. Like occasionally I'd looked out of the back of a truck as we were driving somewhere and see one by the roadside or in a ditch. And of course that must have been very different from those actually at the sharp end.